The Integrity Sound on the Octagon of House of Representatives Resources Committee. We're going to call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is now 1:15, 16 p.m., Friday, March 18th, 2022. Here with us, giving us a quorum, is everybody but Representative Hannon. I'm sure she'll be joining us momentarily. I'd like to say thank you to our recording secretary, Robin, and our LO moderator, Emma. Please silence your cell phones. As you may recall, we heard House Bill 304, which is the Chugat State Park Eagle River Lions Club bill by Representative Merrick. And we're going to also pick up House Bill 299, which is the micro-reactors bill by the governor that was rescheduled for Monday. Going right into it with House Bill 304, we last heard it on Wednesday and received no amendments from members. And I'd like to give the opportunity to make allow members to make closing comments on the bill if they'd like before we turn it over to the sponsor. No comment, Representative Gillum.
Actually, thank you, Mr. Chair. Had somebody ask me a question about if the Lions give this up, it reverts back to the park. Where in the bill does it say that? I mean, how would they know if that would happen?
We've got folks online, Representative Merrick, if that's fine, I can try to pitch it to either Mr. Boutel or Mr. Geese, unless you guys know otherwise.
Through the chair, Representative Gillum, that's in the memorandum of understanding. It should be in your bill packet between the DNR and the Lions Club.
Okay.
Jamie Jones, staffer, Brett Merrick, for the record.
Okay. Does that suffice, okay, or would you like to hear from the department?
No, that's fine. That's just, I can give that back to the person that asked me. So, thank you.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you, Representative Gillum. Any other comments or questions from committee members before we look to the will? Seeing or hearing none, closing comments, Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, Kelly Merrick, District 14. I just thank the committee for hearing this bill. The people of Eagle River, and I think the people of Alaska, are going to be very excited to see this happen.
Thank you, Representative Merrick. Vice Chair Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 304, Work Order 32-LS0928/I, with committee recommendations and from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Let's go for a hike. Thank you.
Any objection from members? Seeing or hearing none, that it House Bill 304 is now moved. Thank you, Representative Merrick. We'll take a brief at ease while folks have the opportunity to sign the committee report. Back on the record, welcome Representative Hannon joining us. Next, we'll take up House Bill 299. We last heard it on Friday. We have a presentation today from Marcus Nichols of the Nuclear Energy Institute, and Laura Ashe from DEC is here to help run the slides. Mr. Nichols, can you do a sound check, introduce yourself, and then we'll look to you to begin your presentation.
Yes, Chairman, members of the committee, this is a sound check for Mark Nichols.
We can hear you wonderfully. Thank you.
Great. Are you ready to begin?
Yes, sir.
All right, great. Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee, for inviting me here today to talk about microreactors. My name is Mark Nichol. I'm Senior Director of New Reactors at the Nuclear Energy Institute. We are a trade association, so utilities that own nuclear power plants and technology companies that develop these microreactors are our members, and we represent them in front of the government, including Congress, Department of Energy, and our regulators. So I'd like to talk to you today. Go to slide two, please. I'd like to talk to you today about the micro reactors for rural use cases. And the first, just to make sure we're all level set, although I think you know this well, the micro reactor technology itself is really designed up front to replace diesel generators like those that are used in many rural areas. There's a couple of pictures of a few of the designs, but what makes them suitable for replacing diesel generators are, one, the very small size. They have to be the right size power output, but not just that. They have to take up a very small footprint in order to be able to fit in areas where diesel generators are. Land is very much a premium. They have to be able to be shipped into these rural areas. They have to be resilient when they're out there, whether they're all alone or whether they're paired with renewables and energy storage systems. They need to provide the resilience to withstand and mitigate and quickly recover from extreme natural events, also man-made physical cyber threats. I'll talk about those a little bit more later. And then in the operations, they have to perform like a diesel generator. They have to have automatic operations. They have to be flexible to match the demand and integrate with other sources. Slide three, please.
Mr. Nichol, before we move to the next slide, Representative Hannon has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Nichol, the road shippable phrase I've read a couple times, and that's what draws my attention, because although we do have remote locations in Alaska that are road accessible, most of our road system, we actually use that as a term in Alaska, our road system is connected on a grid, and our most remote locations that are generator dependent aren't road connected. So I want to know about the other shipabilities. Have they been shipped into locations using large aircraft? What kind of vessels for water transport? Because in Alaska, most of rural Alaska is not road deliverable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for the question. Through the chair, thank you for the question. So when we talk about road shippable, what we're talking specifically about is that they're the size and weight that could fit on the back of a semi-trailer. And they can be shipped by other modes of transportation. Certainly by barge, if there's a waterway, they can be moved into the location there. The Department of Defense is working on demonstrating that they can be shipped by aircraft. Now, those would be C-40s. They're probably not the type of airfields that are at the rural areas. But they should be they should be able to be shipped in there because they're the size and weight. That are similar to a diesel generator. If you can get a diesel generator in there, you'll be able to get these in there.
Does that suffice, Representative Hannon?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions before we move on with the presentation? Seeing none, Mr. Nichol.
Thank you. Moving on to slide three, the market opportunities for these microreactors, there are two types. There are stationary and then they're mobile. Mobile means that they can be set up very quickly. This is more of an interest to Department of Defense, where they need to stand them up within 3 days and then be able to remove them from site within 7 days. That's the somewhat definition of mobility. And they would be used for rapid response type of things. The stationary are really what I think are being considered in Alaska. And those could be remote villages. They could be mining. They could be the defense installations like Eielson Air Force Base or even microgrids in more urban areas. And when we say stationary, they're intended to be there their entire life. Now, some microreactors will be refueled every 10 years. Others might be every 20 years. But even when you refuel it, the building would be reusable. You could replace it with another reactor vessel and fuel. So they're almost like batteries. You pull one out and put a new battery in. Any questions?
There are none. Please continue.
All right. Thank you. With that introduction, slide four, please. With that introduction, there are four main topics I wanted to cover today. Based on what I've heard about your interesting questions previously. I want to talk about the costs and the workforce for microreactors, safety and security, used fuel and decommissioning, and then finally, what are the current deployment plans and policies that are available. Moving down to slide six, we'll start with a cost comparison here. And this compares our cost estimates of microreactors with cost of diesel generators. And the diesel generator, which is the orange bar on the far right, is primarily just the fuel cost. We did not incorporate capital costs. Many times those are already amortized. We didn't capture the O&M costs. We wanted to focus strictly on fuel to see if they're competitive for that reason. And the blue costs there on the left part of that chart are the microreactors. I should mention for the diesel generators, we used $2.86 a gallon to $4.89 a gallon for diesel. That provides that range. That includes the sort of transportation surcharge that would increase the cost of diesel. The microreactors, we included all the costs. We included used fuel and decommissioning costs. We included capital costs, operating costs, and fuel costs. We did assume that it would be refueled once every 10 years, and we assumed that it would be 40-year plant life. So you would basically have four nuclear batteries. You'd have one come in, operate 10 years, after 10 years, switch it with a new one and do that for the 40 years. We did also assume that it operated at a high capacity factor. We know that they can operate at that high capacity factor. The question is whether it would need to be flexible and in that instance would not produce 95% of the time. We do have other slides that look at what the impact is, and the impact is minimal all the way down to about 50-60% capacity factor. There is slight increases, but it's not significant. Any questions?
Questions from community representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. So just because I don't know much about this industry, we don't have it in Alaska, but are there commercial operators who take your spent fuel? And I know that you've incorporated those in those costs, but I assume, again, from a remote location in Alaska, the secured storage and transport of it back to the fuel disposal location. Where are those, and do they charge a rate depending on what the market demand is, or are there set dedicated ones that once you would buy a reactor that you have a 40-year disposal agreement that it's always going to go there and the price is fixed?
Yeah, through the chair, I'll discuss in more detail the current used fuel approach in later slides. So But to mention here, microreactors are looking at a different model for addressing used fuel, where the current reactors and most other advanced reactors plan to store the used fuel on site until a final disposal repository is available. Most of the microreactor companies that I've talked with are planning to take back that used fuel. They would take it back to, I'll just call it a refurbishment facility, because that reactor vessel can be reused again. And so they would just remove the used fuel. They would store it there on site at the refurbishment facility, and it would not stay in at the microreactor location. Those costs would be included. Those used fuel management costs would be included in this analysis. And I will say that used fuel management costs are very small compared to the other costs of a microreactor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nickel. Any other questions before we move on with the presentation? Seeing none, please proceed.
I might have just had an internet freeze. Any other questions?
There are no other questions. Please proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Slide number 7 is looking at the cost of microreactors over a couple of different market segments. So let me first describe the microreactor costs that were assumed here. Those are the red, purple, and blue lines that go across the page. And that's a high cost, a middle cost, which is the best estimate, and then the low cost, which is the most optimistic. And each of those assumed a different amount of cost reduction as you continue to build, because we know that as you build more and more of these, the cost curve goes down. It's been demonstrated in nuclear before. It's been demonstrated for renewables, and it's widely observed phenomenon for all types of technologies. And so that's the range there. And then the colored boxes are the different markets, the costs of energy generation in the different markets. Those don't include the transmission overhead and that sort of thing, and it's primarily the fuel cost there. What we see, the biggest takeaways here, is that even the first microreactor at the highest expected cost, they're cost competitive in some of the remote Arctic communities. At the most optimistic cost, they're competitive in almost all of them, and possibly even the Alaska Rail Belt. As you continue to reduce costs, then it just becomes more and more competitive in those markets. Any questions?
Seeing none, please proceed.
All right, slide 8, please. I wanted to talk a little bit about financing the capital cost, because there is nuclear, as you may already know, is a high capital cost technology with very low fuel and operating cost. And so let's talk about the financing of that. So if we look at a 5-megawatt reactor, based on our cost estimates, that would be about $50 million to $100 million in overnight capital cost that would need to be financed. Now, under the conventional model, the local utility would finance those capital costs. Typically, they would borrow debt, usually at low rates, especially co-op and muni type of utilities. They get a large amount of financing for low rates, and we've seen a lot of investor interest in the UAMPS project as well. Now, microreactor companies are looking at different business models, where it would be more of a subscription rather than a pay up front type of approach. And in that subscription model, the developer would own and operate the plant, or they might use an intermediary to operate the plant. And they would sell the power by a power purchase agreement. So in that case, the local utility doesn't need to finance the capital costs. They only pay for the power that they receive. So there's some similarities and differences between those two models. In both, the customer, the ratepayer for that electricity, they only pay as the levelized cost of electricity, those numbers that I showed, based on the power they're consuming, regardless of each. Now, it does make a difference for the utility. So in the new business model, the developer is bearing the bulk of that financial risk of the project. And so that insulates the utility. If they're not financing that capital project, then, they're not at risk if anything would happen, to that. So that is something that's unique with microreactors, and what some of the developers are offering. Any questions?
No, Mr. Nickel, please proceed.
All right, thank you. Slide 9. The workforce for microreactors, the target is less than 10 employees, to borrow rural areas. Now, a nuclear power plant today has a lot more workers. They have workers on site 24 hours a day. Likely, these first microreactors will also have several workers on site 24 hours a day. That's where you get to about 10. If you have four or five shifts, that's 2 to 3 people on site. Maybe if you work it out and have fewer people at night, then you might have more people during the daytime. Now, how are we planning to get to these smaller workforce numbers? There's a couple of technology enablers, and with each of those technology enablers, the NRC, our regulator, will need to sign off on those. And so the first one is in the safety and simplicity of the design. A lot of these just use natural physics, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. In their operation, they almost, they're automatic operations. If there were anything to go wrong, gravity, natural circulation, just things of nature are built into the design to keep it in a safe conditions. So that means that you don't have to rely on human actions to maintain safety. But now you always have a person watching it. You're not just going to leave it, without watching it. So that gets to the minimal workers, and it also reduces the training and qualification requirements. So if you think of a nuclear power plant today, you have to go through a lot of qualifications. Some workers need to have certain college degrees to be able to do that. These microreactors will be able to be the workers will be able to qualify with more of a high school type of degree. The second is automatic operations, and in automatic operations, the operators would be allowed to have other duties because they don't have to be at the controls all the time. They could go off and do some maintenance or administrative type of activities as well. The other is remote operations. So if we get approval by the NRC that somebody can operate this from a central facility far away, then you wouldn't have to have the operator on site. So in that central facility could operate many microreactors spread across the United States. And then the last one is incorporating security by design. So if you're providing security just by the design alone, then you don't have to rely on dedicated armed responders to protect the plant, or at least not as many. So what does this mean? I put it here in the context of two types of locations. One I call a hub area. The other I call a spoke area. The hub area would be characterized as a population size that can supply the workers. Let's just call it the 10 employees. And so whatever size population that might be, I happen to be born in a very small town that today has about 1,000 people in it. And I think a town with 1,000 people could easily supply 10 workers for a microreactor. In these hub areas, they could obviously use the electricity directly and heat as well, whether it's district heating or whether it's heating for industrial processes. And then the spoke areas, this would be an area where there's not a large enough population to supply the workers. And so within those areas, I don't know how small that area would be, but within that, you might have an opportunity to extend transmission lines to that community if it's close enough to the hub area where the microreactor sits. Or you could produce hydrogen or ammonia, some other transportable energy source from the hub area being generated from the microreactor, and then transport that hydrogen or ammonia to the spoke area. And that could be, we'd have to look at the exact economics, but that would be lower cost because it's closer to the source of generating it. And also the microreactors are lowering the energy costs. Any questions here?
I don't see any. Please continue. Representative Hannah?
Okay.
No, I don't need to get into the hydrogen ammonia creation. I don't need a chemistry lesson, but I don't know what it means.
Representative Hannon.
Through the chair, could you explain to us simply and concisely how the microreactors produce hydrogen or ammonia, and then what that distribution of energy looks like from the microreactor out to a spoke area?
Through the chair, yes, I'd be happy to. I'll focus more on hydrogen because it's a little bit simpler. So hydrogen, you basically would burn it so it would be an alternative to diesel fuel. Now it wouldn't work in a diesel generator probably, but you could put it into a we'll just call it a hydrogen burner. So you would burn the hydrogen, and then from that burning of hydrogen, you could make electricity or heat. Now, hydrogen can be made in a couple of different ways. You can actually make hydrogen directly from electricity. It's called electrolysis. So you send electricity through water, and that makes the hydrogen and oxygen separate, and then you can just capture all of the hydrogen. You can actually make hydrogen more efficiently if you use heat to do it. There's some processes called heat-assisted electrolysis. So you basically boil the water so you get it so that the hydrogen and oxygen are more easily separated, and so you don't have to use as much electricity, and you can do that a lot cheaper. And so that's how you create the hydrogen, how you use it. Now, how you transport it, you can actually compress it. And you can compress it down, and so you can have a lot of hydrogen energy compressed down into very small volumes, and then you would just transport that however you would transport other goods.
Follow-up, Representative Hannah.
One follow-up. At the beginning step, is the microreactor the source of the hydrogen, or you're saying this would be separate from the microreactor?
Through the chair, it would be a secondary process. So you could have the microreactor. You could have a different. You could do it with a diesel generator. You could do it with renewables or natural gas. So the microreactor is just providing the power, and then you use that power in a separate process for the hydrogen. So you'd have to build the hydrogen generation piece as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Nickel.
All right, thank you. Slide 10, I'm going to move into safety and security now. Slide 11, please. So microreactors, like other advanced reactors for the industry's developing, is built upon a strong safety record. Not many people know it because we don't talk about it a lot, but the operating fleet or the existing nuclear reactors is actually one of the safest industrial working environments in the U.S. When you look at it in terms of injuries and deaths and that sort of stuff, it's one of the lowest. And if you look at it from radiological incidents, there's really zero in the United States from radiological hazards. And so the question is, why is that? Well, it's because it's built upon a couple of things. A very strong independent regulator, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They have some of the highest, probably the highest standards in the world. Many people refer to them as the gold standard for nuclear regulation. The nuclear reactors are built tough. We'll talk a little bit more about how they're built for extreme weather events and other threats. And then operational performance as well. This was a recognition that the better you perform in your operations is directly tied to operating safely. It also happens to benefit financially. And so what we actually see is there is a connection between good operations, financial viability, and safety. So cost and safety go hand in hand. They're not opposed. This is all being built upon, and then we're enhancing it for advanced reactors, recognizing that the current reactors are safe and very safe, but if we can make them safer, let's do it. And so the safety of microreactors are very different than the existing reactors, one, because the designs are so different, especially in terms of the size. There's three main areas where microreactors try to enhance safety. The first are these inherent safety features. I mentioned it earlier, the natural physics. So it's natural circulation, and natural circulation is where if you have heat on the bottom and you have cold on the top, that when you heat the water on the bottom or the fluid on the bottom, it'll rise up. And then when you cool it on the top, it'll fall down. And so if you place that heat source and that cold source in the right places and you develop the channels inside, it'll actually flow in a circle. And what it's doing is just by natural physics, it's transporting heat from one place to another. And so that's what we mean by natural circulation. Gravity would just be that there are certain systems that by the force of gravity, they would keep the reactors safe. They're built on robust and hardened structures, failed safe components, meaning that if you lose electricity or power, or if anything happens to it, it fails in a safe condition. So whatever condition it's in, it would revert to a safe condition. And then the operational simplicity in these. There's very few instruments and controls. The fewer instruments and controls you have, the fewer things that can go wrong. So the second category is reducing risk. And the first is a much smaller radionuclide inventory. So these reactors are 1 to 10 megawatts generally. And the current reactors are 1,000 megawatts. Some are even bigger than that. So you're talking about 1/1,000th of the amount of radioactive material as a current reactor. And that has a lot of benefits because there's a lot less heat being generated after you shut down. We call that decay heat. It's one of the features of nuclear reactors is after you shut it down, you have, because some of the material is radioactive, it's actually, as it decays, it produces radiation and heat. So that radiation and heat is much, much less, and it's easier to control. That means there's much less potential for accidents, and it's much easier to mitigate any consequences if an accident is happening. We're using fuel that's proliferation resistant. It's all low-enriched uranium that's less than 20%, and so it's very good from that standpoint. And finally, an emergency response. So we've built it so nature will keep it safe. We've reduced the risks of if anything happens that wasn't planned for. And then if anything that's, not credible, we say, happens, then we have emergency response. And what is that emergency response? Well, it's the ability to maintain it safe for a very long time, many of these indefinitely. without the need for power or coolant or human action. Those were the three things that were needed in Fukushima that they didn't have. And so here, you actually don't need them, so those types of accidents wouldn't occur. And we have emergency planning. If anything goes wrong, we've thought about what are the right actions to take in those conditions. Any questions on this slide?
I don't see any. Please proceed.
All right, thank you. On to slide 12. I want to talk a little bit more about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission because they have to review and approve all of these designs, and they have to approve those designs to be used at a specific site. And then after that, they actually continue to provide oversight and inspection. So I'll talk about all of that. So first, in terms of the review, they do look at the design and its capabilities. They look at the site and its features, what types of earthquakes you might have, what types of flooding you might have, to make sure that your design is robust and can withstand all of those. And they review that. They call here my numbers are all related to a safety review. There's also an environmental review. But they review, and these facts are all for a large reactor. A micro reactor is likely to be less than this, but this just shows how rigorous the reviews are. The application itself is thousands of pages. A NuScale application, which is the most recent advanced reactor that was approved by the NRC, was 12,000 pages long. That's just the application. That's the material that was formally submitted to the NRC and is controlled afterward. The NRC went and looked at even more information than that. They actually looked at about 2 million pages worth of information. Those go down into the calculations, the inputs, the outputs. The NRC is very thorough in their job. And so that shows itself in the resources expended. The typical review for larger reactors is 3 to 4 years, and that's just the safety review. There's other procedural steps before and after that, and the fees are $45 to $68 million historically, and that's about 200,000 person hours. So these are very, very rigorous and robust. We do think that there's opportunities for efficiency. We're working with the NRC to see if they can make it more efficient. And we do expect micro reactors to be less than this, just based on their simplicity and lower hazards. But those are figures just to demonstrate how rigorous the NRC is. The NRC coordinates with other agencies. The Department of Homeland Security and other agencies are involved in defining the design basis threat. I'll talk about this more a little bit later. The design basis threat is the bad guys, the characteristics of the bad guys that would come and attack a nuclear power plant or try to steal material, so it'd be like terrorist type of things. We'll talk a little bit more about that. And then FEMA is involved in emergency planning. In fact, state emergency planning agencies also get involved, and they have even their own discussions with the proposed projects. And then finally, public involvement. The NRC's one of their principles of good regulation is transparency, and they have a lot of engagement with the public. The public can file contentions on the application from the very beginning. In a contention, the NRC will treat that with all seriousness, to make sure, one, it has merit, and then if it has merit, that it's appropriately addressed. And there's hearing opportunities at the end of the process, so the public gets to a lot of engagement in that. Any questions on this slide?
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Nickel, the fee for the design review has caught my attention just to the scale. This is for a current nuclear project. What's your expectation for a micro reactor review cost? Is it going to be half that?
Yeah, it's a good question. We don't know just yet. And keep in mind that once they approve the design, every time they review the same design at a new site, it's going to be a lot less. So this is, you can also think of this as sort of overhead cost for a microreactor that they would make up in volume. So I don't know exactly what we would expect the microreactor cost to be. Certainly less than half, I think would be a reasonable. I don't know if it would quite be a quarter of that or more or less, but yes.
Follow up. Do you have a ballpark of what you would speculate that the cost to bring a microreactor from design through the NRC process to permitting to bring online? Because I guess I just hadn't fathomed the scale. And in most remote parts of Alaska, now if I separate out industrial mines where we're not going to know how much gold's under the ground, but I would speculate that very few of our communities could amortize over a 50 or 40 year life of a project that's in the $100 million range. But with this just being the cost of review, I'm going to assume that that's right now kind of what it's going to take to bring a microreactor into approval and deployment. Or are they, we just don't know yet. But.
Yeah, through the chair. So the NRC licensing fees were included in the capital cost of the cost projections I showed earlier in the slide. My best guess for a reasonable number of where I think microreactors can get, I think they could get down to a 2-year review and a $10 million review. It may not be for the very first one, but again, once the NRC approves that design, they have a process called design certification. Once they approve that design, they don't have to review it over and over again. And so they just look at the site characteristics. And so each site license application could be much, much less than that. The NRC is working on processes that would help to streamline it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nickel. Any other questions from committee members? Seeing none, I'll just say on your NRC resources expended bullet, thank you for not bringing 2 million pages of presentation.
Yes, you're welcome.
Please
thank
proceed.
You for that. Slide 13. Last slide about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. What does an NRC approval mean? So the NRC spent all that money and reviewed all those pages, but what does that approval actually mean? So it means four different things. The first, it means safety. And so these bullets here are actually talking about this is the regulatory standards that the NRC has. So if they approve something, they have to meet these standards. They could exceed these standards, and many do, but at a minimum, they have to meet the standards. So in terms of safety, it means that the risk from the nuclear plant to the public is much lower than other societal risks. Other societal risks are things like cancer, car accidents, it's even falling and drowning, which happen to be some of the most, the highest risks. And what does much lower mean? Well, it's 0.1%. So 1/1,000, is the measure. So it's a lot safer than just, regular hazards in the society. And then what does that mean on a radiation dose, basis? If we talk about that, well, the dose to the public has to be less than 100 millirem per year. And I don't expect you to understand exactly what, the millirems mean. So I have this chart on the right. Millirem is just the measurement unit, for radiation dose to the body. Well, what is 100 millirem? It's, if I look here, a chest x-ray is somewhere up in the 700 millirem. So it's 1/7 of just the chest x-ray. It appears to be, no, sorry, the chest x-ray is 10. That was a upper gastrointestinal x-ray, sorry. And a head CT scan looks to be about 200 millirem. So you're talking the medical procedures that people have every day, and there's very low risk to that. That's the maximum dose somebody can receive from a nuclear power plant. And I have a note down here that the actual dose, here's the average dose from just eating and drinking water, this banana, beans, meats, carrots, is 30 millirem. So, and the chart here says the dose from living next to a nuclear power plant is usually less than one millirem. So, and those are for the large reactors, and these are being designed to enhance the safety even more. So the radiation dose is less than what you get just from eating bananas, beans, meats, carrots, and such. The second is insecurity. So the safety, then security. It's the protection against radiological sabotage, and this is the design basis threat that I was talking about. And I can't tell you what that design basis threat characteristics are. That safeguards information. People with the right clearance can get access to that information. But it's very rigorous set of characteristics. The NRC looks at things like the 9/11 attacks. It looks at the current terrorism capabilities and a lot of other things, and that's how they establish the standard by which these plants have to withstand bad actors. And I'll say for the operating fleet, they have, we call them force-on-force drills. These are mock exercises where you have a group that pretends they're the bad actors, and they try to make an assault on a nuclear power plant. And they don't succeed, but I'll tell you, a lot of times those adversary forces are comprised of people that came from the special forces in the military. So these are highly sophisticated, protected against highly sophisticated attacks. And that means not just the attack to try to do damage to that plant, it's the attack to try to steal the material and use it for other purposes. And the NRC has the same type of security and safety requirements for the transportation of this material. In terms of emergency planning, we talked about that as the backup to the backup to the backup for nuclear safety. What it means, emergency planning zone, you may have heard of the current emergency planning zones are 10 miles from a nuclear power plant. And we think that microreactors will have emergency planning zones at the site boundary. What's the site boundary? It could be 100 feet or so, but it's not very large. I talked about how these, you know, would be about a quarter of an acre in size. What that means is the worst dose that would be at the boundary of that emergency planning zone, about 100, let's just say it's 100 feet from microreactor, is less than one rem. And you can look at the dose chart and see that one rem is not that harmful. So that's why if you think of these, wow, one rem occurs for an existing plant out at 10 miles, one rem for these occurs right at the site boundary. So if the worst case happens, as long as you stay more than that site boundary away, everything is you have really no risk. And then finally in the environmental, the NRC looks at the environmental. They make sure that the NEPA, National Environmental Protection Act, requirements are met, and they confirm that other environmental laws are met, like the water and air. Other agencies like EPA reviews those, but the NRC cannot issue a license until they have confirmation that you've met all those other environmental permits. Any questions on this slide?
Seeing none, no. Please proceed, Mr. Nickel.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Slide 14, we're going to move on to used fuel and decommissioning. Slide 15. So a lot of people ask about nuclear waste. We call it used fuel. We call it used fuel because it still has 95% of the energy, potential energy, still in it. Used fuel only uses 4% of the total potential energy, and so it could be reused in the future. But a lot of people ask, and what are you going to do about the waste? And there's concern because it emits radiation and is radioactive material, and it's somewhat unique compared to other technologies. But I'll say, no matter what technology you have, all energy sources have waste, and all must do at least the following three things to address it. First, you have to be able to manage it safely, and we can do that with used nuclear fuel. Used fuel to begin with is solid and it's compact, so it's very low volume, and it's solid, which means it's very easy to manage. And we have proven technology to address it. The question was asked earlier how we do it. There's technology with steel canisters, some use concrete, as well, to store it in that. And you can transport it safely as well with similar type canisters. And in fact, we've transported over 1,300 used fuel shipments safely in the United States. A lot of people don't realize how much used fuel we ship in the United States, but we do, and we do it safely. The second thing you have to do for waste is you have to be able to pay for it. One of the very unique things about nuclear energy is that we collect we plan and collect the funds to be able to manage and dispose of used fuel and decommission the site as we operate up front. Now we do that because U.S. law requires it, but it means that we have the funds to pay for it. In fact, if you look at just the funds to pay for the final disposal, there's $40 billion right now in the nuclear waste fund, which is more than enough to be able to dispose of that. And so we've got the money to pay for used fuel management and disposal. And then the third thing you have to have is a place to put it. And the Department of Energy, by law, is required to take and dispose of used fuel. There is a by law, Yucca Mountain was designated as the location. It's been studied. It's been found technically suitable for used fuel disposal. That's been confirmed by the NRC. Now, there is a discussion about whether it should still be Yucca Mountain or if we should embark on a consent-based process to pick a different location. Consent-based means that the community itself wants it. And so that continues to be a discussion, and that's why the used fuel is still at the site while we're waiting to figure that solution out in Congress. But I'll say that the technology we have to store the used fuel safely can store it safely for hundreds of years. And so we have the time to make sure we make the right decision on this final disposal facility. And I'll reiterate that most of the microreactor companies are looking at actually taking back the fuel soon after the refueling. Some may be able to do that in the measurement of days, weeks, months. Others, perhaps they need a year or two for the fuel to cool down before they can put it on the road. But they all have plans to take that back. Any questions on this slide?
Thank you, Mr. Nickel. Representative Crow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been just a little bit of chat about this, you know, in our different areas once this topic came up. And that's one of the items of, you know, some of people, the fear factor is, oh, my God, you know, they want to get to Alaska so we can create a dumping ground, you know, or storage area in Alaska for that. And obviously I would not support that. But where exactly is this fuel stored at? Is there a major place in the United States that fuel stored? Question.
Currently, all of the used fuel is stored at the location where it was produced. And so at the nuclear reactor that's still operating, or there's a few places that have shut down, decommissioned, and the used fuel is still staying there. There is work to develop what's called a consolidated interim storage facility. and that would be a central location. You could send the used fuel to and store it there. There's been work in New Mexico and Texas for a couple locations where the communities have been supportive, and that's not underway yet. But there is work on that.
Follow up. Quick question. So, a mini micro reactor here. How much fuel is in it spent? If it's alive, how much is actually spent? Gallons, truckload?
So the fuel in its physical characteristics doesn't change. It's the same size and shape because it's solid. The only thing that happens is that there's changes in the atoms inside, which you wouldn't be able to see. So it would be the same exact size as the reactor that came in. So that would fit on the back of a truck or, you know, whatever other conveyance you use to get it there. You could take the fuel out and then you could put it probably in a smaller container because the reactor is built with other features in it. But most of the micro reactor companies that I'm hearing from are planning to do that back at a refurbishment center.
Thank you.
Thank you. And so I guess just to characterize one of the discussions that I had pre-meeting for this bill, I kind of asked the same question. What are we left with the trash? And it was kind of put upon me that there's the little fuel cell itself, and then it's wrapped in this big ceramic or covered in this big ceramic, and it's about the size of a big kitchen trash can is kind of the analogy that I was given. Is that fair to say?
Yes, Chair. That's a fair assessment.
Thank you.
Yeah, about the size of a kitchen trash can.
Please proceed.
All right, thank you. On slide 16, talking now about final disposal. So while the United States I talked about is still determining whether it should be Yucca Mountain or a consent-based siting approach, other countries are moving forward. Many of them are moving forward with consent-based siting processes, meaning that the communities that have been selected or are being considered want to be selected and are being considered. And so there are a number of countries, Finland, Sweden, France, Canada, Switzerland, in different levels of progress. Some of them have actually picked the final location where the community is very happy about it and is getting that licensed. And Finland is one of the furthest furthest along, and it's actually under construction. So there are communities that would like to have a disposal facility because it will be operated safely, and there are some benefits to it. And not all communities will want to, and that's fine too. We're not trying to advocate or push a disposal facility on any community that wouldn't want it. And I talked a little bit about the consolidated interim storage. There are other countries with that, and I mentioned the U.S. Companies pursuing a solution there. Any questions on this slide?
Representative Crum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if let's just say we decide that we're going to do this in Alaska. So I guess there's a lot of decisions to be made, but I guess it would be safe to say most of us would be on the side of caution that we would not want our fuel stored in Alaska. So
thank you, Representative Crum. Any other comments? Mr. Nickel, if you'd like to respond.
Chair and Representative. I think having a reactor in Alaska does not mean that you'll get a repository or you would even be considered for one. I think a community would have to stand up and say we want it, and the state would have to say you want it. So if you never say you want it, then I think you would not be considered.
Thank you. Please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. Slide 17. The last thing I'll end with what I started with talking about used fuel is that most of what remains still has potential energy value. Now, why don't we recycle fuel today? Largely because of economics. It's cheaper to mine new uranium than it is to recycle uranium, use fuel, and so we'll continue to do that. But somewhere in the future, it'll be cheaper to recycle than it is to get new uranium, and so there is always that opportunity. Now, it's interesting that there are some advanced reactor companies that are actually pursuing recycling even now. They find that they've developed new processes for recycling that are lower cost. And in fact, Oklo has had a recent announcement with Argonne National Laboratory on how they're going to develop that technology for reprocessing used fuel. Any questions on this slide?
I don't see any. Please proceed.
Thank you. Slide 18, deployment plans and policies. Moving on to slide 19. There are a lot of policies out there for government support. The first and most important policy is to value all carbon-free sources of energy equally. And so we've seen a number of states and the federal government move from renewable-only policies to clean energy policies, which include nuclear. And so getting fair value is really important. Beyond that, there are some nuclear-specific programs that the federal government has. They're paying for some demonstration projects. I'll talk about a few later. They're offering tax credits to help overcome first-of-a-kind costs, loan guarantees, and there's even opportunities for federal power purchase agreements. And all of those things that the government's doing to help get advanced nuclear microreactors into the market are the same policy tools they use to help renewables and other sources get into the market. So we know that they're effective. At the state level, various states are looking at different types of policies. I didn't bring my list here today. But some are looking at study bills. Some are repealing moratoriums, similar to what you all are considering, which is, repealing the requirement for legislative approval. Others are looking at tax incentives and other things to actually give financial incentives. So it's whatever makes sense for the state. That's what the states are looking at. Any questions on this slide?
Thank you, Mr. Nickel. Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. Through the chair, I was just wondering, the happy medium here, I guess, in the discussion would be somewhere around 20 megawatts or 25. So what size chunk of uranium are we talking about for a reactor that size?
That's a good question. I don't have the numbers. I'll have to go back and get them for you. But it's a small amount. If it's okay, I'll get those answers and get back to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nickel. I don't see any other questions on slide 19. Please proceed.
All right. Thank you. Slide 20. So now we're getting into the plans of where people are looking at advanced nuclear projects. These are not only microreactors, but they are the ones that have been discussed in the public domain. It's more than 20 projects between the U.S. and Canada. I'll focus here on some of the microreactor ones that's going to be on the next slide. But you do see the two in Alaska that are going to show up in the next slide. And then the green shading for the states are states that have passed policies to support advanced reactors. We're not we didn't color code the ones that are considering. So if Alaska were to pass its bill, we would show it as green on that slide. Any questions on this, or it might be better to wait until I go on slide 21.
Yeah, go ahead and go to slide 21 and we'll see if there are questions on both.
Okay, excellent. This is actually my last slide as well. So this discusses, it gives a little bit more detail about those projects that were on the previous page. We have a handful of microreactor companies with projects that have been discussed in the public. And so we'll talk a little bit about those here. Oklo is looking at deploying an Aurora, a 1.5 megawatt reactor at the Idaho National Laboratory with an online date in a couple of years. They also have an agreement with Compass Mining. They don't have locations announced, but that's up to 150 megawatts that they would provide to them. UltraSafe has projects in both Canada and the United States. They have a demonstration at their Chalk River Laboratory. That's a national laboratory like INL. They have a project ongoing with University of Illinois and the MOU that you're likely familiar with, Copper Valley. The interesting thing I'll say here, because it brings in Canada is very interested in microreactors in rural areas for largely the same reason that the constituents in Alaska are interested in microreactors, trying to replace diesel generators, being in very far off areas that are difficult to get to except for a couple times a year. And so I think there's a lot of synergies between Canadian interest and Alaskan interest. Westinghouse is also doing work in Canada and the United States, and Radiant has some plans in Idaho as well. Differing designs, most of those are 1 to 10 megawatts. You're familiar, I'm sure, with the Air Force's interest in a microreactor at Eielson Air Force Base. And the Department of Defense is working on that mobile version of microreactor that I talked about. We would expect to hear more information soon from them on their technology selection. With that, that's the end of my presentation. If there's additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nickel, Representative Hannah.
Thank you, through the chair. And actually, maybe my question is for other committee members, because I did miss one hearing that we had on micronuclear reactors. The only project before we flipped to this map that I had heard of being discussed in Alaska was the Eielson Air Force Base project. So I'm a little surprised to see Copper Valley on there. But I know that I've got a couple members on this committee who represent that district, and we've got members who are on the Energy Committee. But I guess sort of my overarching is, of the two Alaska projects that are in development, which one is closer to, I mean, like I said, I'd only ever heard of the Eielson one. So I'm just curious what we know about the Copper Valley one.
I'm just out of caution, I'll defer your question to probably them, because I can give it to you, but I want to make sure that I'm correct. Because I don't believe it's Valdez. I don't think it's Valdez. I think it's the house. Someone will be faster.
Mr. Nickel, do you, through the chair, follow it? Mr. Nickel, do you know which of the two projects that are on your little chart here on page 21 are closer to, I guess we call, decision-making or needing approval?
Through the chair, yes, it would be the Eielson Air Force Base would be further along. They're planning to issue a request for proposal soon, and with a goal of selecting a vendor by the end of the year. That could slip depending on schedules, but that's their target. So they're closer to making a decision. The Copper Valley was, I think, about a month ago, they issued a press release that they had entered into an MOU with UltraSafe Nuclear to explore more of the feasibility. So I wouldn't call it a decision to build just yet. I think they're still in the exploratory phase.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nickel. Any other questions from committee members before we wrap up the presentation? Representative McKay.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Nickel, thank you very much for your presentation. There's just a couple things I'm trying to visualize. Maybe normal diesel generator, you've got the power end and you've got the electric end. You're basically spinning a turbine that creates electricity. In one of these micro reactors, correct me if I'm wrong, the cylinder or the container of the uranium creates heat, apparently enough to make steam. And then that turns some type of turbine, and then that in turn turns the electric generator part, and out the end of it you get electricity. So that's got to be pretty hot to make steam. I'm just trying to kind of visualize a diagram of how these things are set up inside one of these Herkable containers. Just, you know, what's different than a diesel generator? You're obviously creating power. How do you get there from the cylinder of uranium, I guess is what I'm asking.
Yeah. Through the chair, very good question, and you're basically right that the nuclear reactor core, it produces the fission. The fission produces lots of heat, and then you have a way of transferring that heat from the source of heat. Yeah, thank you for going to that slide. The one on the far right, the radiant kaleidos, gives you the best view inside of the container. So you create the heat in that fission area, and then you have a way of transporting the heat from there to the, I'll just say the generator, because there's different technologies on, you know, how you're actually spinning and making electricity. Some may produce steam, some may use the heat directly in a different type of cycle. But there's different ways of transporting the heat. Some use heat pipes, and a heat pipe is, think of it as type of a straw, but it's, if you've never seen a heat pipe, and I hadn't seen one until about a year or two ago, they're pretty amazing. Is as soon as it touches a hot or cold, something of a very different temperature, immediately on the other end, it reaches the exact same temperature. So it and it's a capillary system. Think of it as sort of like a sponge. So you know how a sponge will suck water all the way through it? That's what it's doing to the heat. It's sucking heat, but it does it so fast. And so you get a lot of heat transfer very quickly through those heat pipes. Other technologies that don't use heat pipes, they'll use, say, helium as it's a gas coolant, and it'll have some way of circulating in there through some type of process, and that would transfer the heat to the other side. But then, yeah, on the other side, it may not. Some of the technologies may not produce steam to drive that turbine. Some may use the heat directly, or they might use supercritical CO2, carbon dioxide. There's a couple different ways.
Follow up. Okay, so I guess what I'm trying to point out for my colleagues is, you know, there are some moving parts inside these things. It's not sort of like Star Trek where it just happens, right? I mean, there are moving parts. There's things that can break. I happen to be an engineer, so I know things can break. We're going to have one of these out in a remote part of Alaska. We're going to have technicians that can repair it. And I looked on the table here. It looks like the Eielson reactor design has not been determined. I was going to ask you which one of these four was going to Eielson, but maybe we don't know. Westinghouse, Radiant, UltraSafe, or Oklo. Do we have any idea which one's going to Eielson?
Through the chair, no, we don't know which one is going to Eielson. They haven't made their selection, so they'll issue a request for proposal. We expect soon, and if things go well, they may pick the design by the end of the year.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and I have a lot of other questions, but we could get really into the weeds pretty fast. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative McKay and Mr. Nickel. Representative Krong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just got a quick question. So I know it produces heat. So how much excess heat would there be from one of these plants? Because, I mean, I know that's one of the advantages. It actually creates heat. And so I guess if we're going to use this in a place –
How much extra heat is there to use besides producing the electricity part?
That's a good question. I don't have a specific answer, but yeah, it does have, it can, so it depends on the heat process that you're planning to use. If you're planning to use a very high temperature, intensive heat process like metal reforming or chemical processing, then you may need to use most of the heat for that, and not be able to do it exactly heat and electricity exactly at the same time. If you're looking at low heat requirement processes like district heating that can take much lower temperatures to use, then you could, for some systems, I don't know the details of the designs, you could produce electricity and then the cooler gas that's coming out and returning back to the heat source, that could still be at a temperature that's high enough to power district heating.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Nickel, for your presentation and all the information within the slides. Very much appreciated. With no questions, we'll set the bill aside. We'll be in touch with members when we decide to pick it back up. And with that, next week's schedule is posted. We don't have anything specific for Monday, but we will start RIK later in the week, I think. Yeah, so we've got two royalty and kind donation bills that we're probably not as familiar with just because it hasn't happened in a handful of years. So we'll all bear with each other as we work through those things. So look forward to seeing you guys next week and have a good weekend. Meeting's adjourned at 2:32.